Hi, welcome to Life Matters. Michael McKenzie here. It might have been an extraordinary week in federal parliament, but guess what? There's been some pretty remarkable things happening elsewhere as well, including in Australia's energy production, and that's where we're starting today. Yesterday, the Climate Council announced renewable power sources reached record highs in all mainland states in 2021, while gas generation fell to the lowest level in more than 15 years as a source of power. On top of that, at the end of last year, one place in the world made international headlines by breaking the global record for the longest unbroken use of renewable energy to power its needs. And where is this magical green utopia? Well, it's a place called South Australia. And in December, SA produced more than 100% of its energy from renewable sources alone for 6 days straight, making that global record. My next guest today says all of Australia can follow that state's lead and more to become by 2035, that's in 13 years, the world's first completely off-the-grid country. The answer, he says, is contained in just two words, electrify everything. Dr. Saul Griffith is an inventor, he's an entrepreneur, an engineer. He's known as one of the world's most influential voices on renewable electricity. In fact, he's been a former advisor to President Joe Biden on US energy policy. He's just moved back to his native Australia to focus on his new organisation called Rewiring Australia. And Saul Griffith has just released a new book. It's called The Big Switch, Australia's Electric Future. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Saul Griffith to Life Matters. Hello.
Good morning.
Saul, good to have you. South Australia, what a great record to have, 6 days straight of renewables, more than 100% at some stages in those 6 days coming from renewable sources. How do you translate that as a six-day event into the kind of vision you have for this country?
Well, it's really a harbinger of the future, and it is quite amazing. But remember that when we quote those figures right now, we're just talking about the electricity supply, which is in South Australia maybe only a third of the energy you use. Remember, there's also the petrol and diesel we use and the natural gas we use for heating water and heating buildings.
Yeah.
Getting to 100% is when we actually electrify all those vehicles to eliminate all those emissions and electrify all of those home heating sources, because that's where the country is really going to start saving even more money. And then that's the vision that the world needs to move to get to truly zero emission economies.
So, Saul, when you say heating, we're talking here about heating our own water for showers and, you know, use in the kitchen, but also I take it space heating, heating our homes.
Heating our homes, which, you know, not such a problem in Northern Territory of Queensland, but ACT, Southern New South Wales, Tasmania, Victoria, quite a lot of natural gas being burned to heat our homes. And then, of course, that includes cooking as well, where we are still heavily reliant on gas. But we now have technology options to, you know, electrify all of those things. And really, that's what I'm advocating for, is that we look at the demand side. That's how we use energy in every aspect of our life, as well as in the supply side, which is how we generate our electricity when we look to making ambitious climate policy.
If you're listening to Saul Griffith talking about this, and we've only just begun, of course, but if you have some questions you might like me to pass on to Saul from your perspective of how this may work in practice in the next 13 years, and you'd like to weigh in with those questions, we'd love to hear from you. It sounds to me, Saul Griffith, like this is a massive change in infrastructure as well as political and civilian thinking. Are you seeing this as being quite a huge challenge?
It's not as massive a change to infrastructure as we might think. And it also represents a little bit of a redefinition of what infrastructure is. We could quite easily generate a quarter or even as much as a half of our energy on our rooftops in Australia. And domestic rooftops aren't traditionally considered part of our infrastructure, but they should be.
Yeah.
And in the future, the largest battery will be our 20 million electric vehicles, and they will be critical in balancing our grid. So we should sort of start to consider our vehicles as part of the national infrastructure. And that's why, you know, I'm an advocate for us actually planning for that future now and really thinking forward to how that infrastructure is going to differ from where we are.
Well, so let's delve into those two areas, rooftop solar and EV, just for a moment, because they are challenging. There's hope, but there's challenge there, as you've acknowledged. Excuse me. So when it comes to rooftop solar, well, I think we're the biggest uptakers of rooftop solar in the world. We lead the way, but one of the issues, as I understand it, is our existing power grid doesn't talk to rooftop solar in the best way possible, and in fact, sometimes actively discourages input from our rooftop solar back into the power grid. So how do we overcome that as a first challenge?
Well, we really need to make sure that we are deploying enough batteries to mop up all of that rooftop solar on the local distribution grid. So that
you're talking about house batteries, every home having its own battery.
Every home having a battery, every car being connected as well. And you know, the home batteries are a little bit expensive today in 2022, but we're watching those prices fall precipitously, and we can now forecast the crossover point for the economics to be, you know, 2024, 2025, which is, you know, we need to be planning for that today, as that's just around the corner.
Okay, so if we talk about that, you think at that stage, if we work out a system perhaps of subsidy and support to get people over the line in purchasing large capital outlays like batteries, that they'll start paying for themselves in the next 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, I think we should look to our success in solar, which really is the envy of the world. We're installing solar at about $1 a watt on the roof. That, after all of the financing, means the cost of electricity for those rooftop solar systems is about six or seven cents per kilowatt hour. That is about a third or a quarter of the price of the electricity you can get from the grid. It's cheaper than any grid-based utility pretty much anywhere in the world. The US is at $3 a watt, which means that rooftop solar in the US is more expensive than the grid. That's why in the US there's only 2% of homes with solar. In Australia, we're now at 30 and rapidly rising, 30%.
Right.
We did that with government subsidies, and the government shaped the market up until the point it started beating the market. We did it with a very clever certification and training program in Australia that trained our tradies to do it and to do a good job, but also eliminate the red tape from the permitting and the inspection processes, which plagues other countries. And so we have a successful model for training, for certification, for government subsidy to get the technologies to where we need them to be cost-wise. If we did the same type of policy for our heat pumps, that's how we heat our spaces and our water. If we had the same type of policies for electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging and for home batteries and for electrifying the kitchen, it would only take a few short years of reasonably small subsidies to get to the point where this mix of technologies will be saving every household money on its fiscal merit. So without the subsidy by about 2025.
Okay, well, while you've been talking, Saul, we've had a few people starting to ask questions from their personal situation. Greg has texted in to say, "Hi, we have a large solar system. We want to change our gas to electric hot water. What are the best options?"
Well, the best option is a heat pump, electric water heater. Heat pump's a magic device. It'll use about one unit of electricity to create 3 or 4 units of heat. So it's about 3 times more efficient than a natural gas heater. They are a few $100 to $1,000 more expensive right now than the natural gas ones, but they do pay for themselves over their lifetime, and they live for about 10 or 12 years. So that's something that's ready to go.
And I think also, Saul, from memory, I've seen that there are government incentive schemes offering to subsidise the purchase and installation of heat pumps in various parts of the country for almost $0.
What's astonishing in Australia is that at the state level, there's the right piece of policy for nearly everything we need to do. ACT is doing the right thing and leading the way on electric vehicles and helping subsidize electric vehicles and vehicle infrastructure. South Australia on home batteries. Lily D'Ambrosio in Victoria is very bullish on electrifying heating inside homes and providing subsidies for electric appliances. So we have it, it all adds up. It's sort of a bit piecemeal at the state level. What we really need is to coordinate that at the federal level and then really work on our electricity network, both the transmission and the distribution networks, so that they can support what is naturally happening on the ground.
Well, let's talk about electric vehicles. We've mentioned it in passing, and I know it's central, you say, to us electrifying everything. At the moment, federal government policy on it is sending mixed signals at its very best when it comes to EV. It's still, any EVs coming into the country are, I think, still classified as a luxury car or luxury vehicle and attracting a certain taxing level that goes with that. While there's been, with the existing federal government, some moves towards, I think, providing more electrical charging outlets across our national road system, I think people quite rightly feel like there's quite a few disincentives in this country to adopt electric vehicles in the way that you would have to see in your vision to make it worthwhile. What needs to happen next in this?
This was made enormously concrete to me this week. I'm doing a book tour for the book that I've just written in a couple of weeks, and I wanted to drive an electric vehicle. And because I just relocated to Australia, I have to borrow one. So I was talking to the head of Toyota Australia and asking if I could borrow one of their prototype electric Land Cruisers. And then I couldn't, sadly, so I'm probably going to rent a Tesla. I said to him, you know, when
why,
are we going to...
Why couldn't you get a Toyota? Just out of interest, what was the problem?
Toyota has bet pretty heavily on hydrogen. I think they're now trying to make it up in electric. But where I was going with that is when am I going to get an electric Toyota? And he says, well, we have deprioritized the Australian market because there are no emission standards in Australia for vehicles. So all of the world's automotive companies have put us at the bottom of the list for electric cars precisely because of our lax federal policy. In California, where I have been living for the last few decades, we're on to our third electric car, my wife and I, and they've been subsidized in less and less each year, and now they're just, you know, much cheaper. You know, in cents per kilometer, it's about 3 cents to drive an electric car. To drive your average petrol vehicle, it's 15 to 20. So yes, they cost more up front, but they save you enormously. So it's crazy that Australia has put ourselves at the bottom of the list for the automotive companies on the world to bring electric vehicles here.
Just on the matter of distances across the country, this is one of the concerns that so many people have. I think it's called range anxiety when it comes to electric vehicles, not only domestically, but also for, you know, heavy industrial use. Saul, are there answers already in place in other countries when it comes to that?
The big batteries are coming. So, you know, when I bought my first electric vehicle about 10 years ago, it could barely do 100 kilometers. In fact, I've got a 10-year-old Nissan electric vehicle van in my driveway here in the Illawarra, and it only does about 120 kilometers, so barely gets to my parents' house in Sydney and back. But we are increasingly seeing 400, 500 kilometer range electric vehicles. So the 2022 fleet looks like that. You were looking at the battery packs that are going into the American truck market now that are 100, 120 kilowatt hour battery packs. They're going to go more than 500 kilometers. And really, it's very few people who can even tolerate driving more than 500 kilometers in a single day.
Yeah, sure.
So we're really crossing that threshold right now. So, you know, the challenge is we're selling this vision for the future of electrify everything today, where not everyone has had a great experience of the electric vehicle, but we've got to look at what's coming, and the big battery packs, the cheap battery packs, are on their way.
My guest is Dr. Saul Griffith. He's an engineer. He's the CEO of his own companies, an inventor, an entrepreneur, founder of Rewiring Australia, former advisor to the Biden government on energy needs and resources, and author of The Big Switch, Australia's Electric Future. And Saul's overall message is electrify everything. We're taking your questions as well. Saul, Jackie asks, what about the resources to build batteries, solar, electric vehicles? What does it take? What's the environmental toll?
So this is a we will have enough of everything we need, and it's actually could environmentally be much better. So today, to live the Australian average lifestyle, about 6 tons or 6,000 kilograms of fossil fuels are burned every year on your behalf. If we electrify everything in your life, those electric machines are about twice as efficient, so you'll use half as much energy, even though your house is just as warm and your car is just as big. And to provide half of that energy with wind, half of that energy with solar, and because they don't blow all the time or the sun isn't shining all the time, we'll store about half of that energy in batteries. And just with that rough heuristic, you'll need about 20 kilograms of solar per year per person, 20 kilograms of wind turbine per year per person, and 20 or 30 kilograms of battery per year per person. They get recycled much more because they're largely metals. So I actually think, you know, if you compare that 6,000 kilograms to the roughly 60 kilograms, in some very crude sense of how much of the earth we're ripping up, we're doing much better when we move to these completely renewable and ultimately recyclable options.
Another question from a text us all. This question is, what governments should be doing to support decarbonisation electrification? Is it just more money, or is it something else they should be providing?
We need to provide not just the automotive companies, but all of the appliance companies with market certainty. Say, here is where Australia is going, and we should have vehicle standards. You know, Norway has said you won't be able to buy anything except a zero emission vehicle in 2025. They'll all be electric 2030 in Britain. So we should have an electric vehicle policy that looks like that. We should be phasing out gas in homes and phasing in these electrical devices. We should be helping the markets transform. We should be optimizing our building codes and zoning laws so that we're not paying excess in regulatory costs for these things. And then we should be investing in our distribution grids and our transmission grid to support the large-scale movement of all of our electricity. And then I really want to contextualize that in terms of what we have to win. When we know that every time you double the amount of solar that we produce globally, the cost falls by 20%. So in fact, the cheap solar we already have is going to fall by 50% again in the next decade. The same is true for electric vehicles, for batteries, and for wind. They're all dropping at 15 to 25% in cost each time we double capacity. That's why, quite remarkably, you know, it's marginal in 2022 to buy this full suite of stuff. But, you know, 2025 to 2026, it's a slam dunk economically. And the costs are falling so quickly that actually by about 2030, you should expect every Australian home to be able to save as much as $5,000 a year on their cost of energy and their cost of transport.
And what about jobs? What about jobs, Saul, in those every Australian homes? Because one of the arguments against the move to renewables is there's no jobs in renewables, and that's why the coal industry needs to keep, you know, meandering along for as long as there's a sustainable market for our exports. What do you say to that when it comes to job replacement?
All of the economic studies of jobs show that there's more jobs per kilowatt hour of delivered electricity in renewables than there are in non-renewables. So there will be jobs in the regions creating these solar farms and wind farms in excess of what we have to lose. Also, think about it. You're going to have tradies visit your house 5 or 6 times to install that electric induction top, to install the vehicle chargers in the garage, the solar on the roof, et cetera, et cetera. That's a huge amount of local jobs that can't be outsourced or offshored because it literally has to visit your house.
Yeah.
And then I think there's a really good economic argument. So take an average suburb. It's got about 1,000 homes in it. those 1,000 homes spend more than $3 million a year right now on petrol and diesel. All of that money immediately leaves their postcode and is not spent in the local economy. When we're driving electric cars powered substantially by rooftop and community renewables, most of that $3 million will stay in the community and circulate in that economy, and that means lots and lots and lots of jobs.
Okay. Well, I mean, that sounds encouraging. It sounds, too, that you're saying and arguing that we need to make these transitions now, and these transitions won't be overnight. It'll be tiny steps as more and more of us in the suburbs of Australia, change over our technology over time, and then we'll start to see real savings down the track. Are you looking for a suburb at the moment to demonstrate what we're talking about here?
You know, yes, I am. Australia really has the opportunity here to lead the world, and to lead the world in getting to that future point where we are creating more jobs and we've got all of those savings happening for individual households. The individual wealthy home might be able to do all of this right now, and so there's a few examples of that. But what the world is sort of delaying on is a whole suburb pilot showing that it can be done and that everyone in that community prospers, eliminate the final risks and concerns about the distribution grid operators who say we won't be able to balance it. But a pilot like that will show that there will be enough batteries in the local community to support it. And so we would love to find a small town in Australia and a suburb that's willing to go all in, run that as a pilot, prove that it works, and quite realistically, in so doing, we would accelerate the whole world's transition to this clean energy economy.
That sounds exciting. But Saul, I guess people who might want to put their hands up as a whole community, you know, it's going to be a whole range of different people living in that community. There's going to be people who own their own property, people who rent their own property. And one of the great areas of concern I know for many people is that if you rent, how do you have sovereignty over your own energy needs and supply?
We do need more thinking and more mechanisms to pass the savings that will occur onto renters. Some of that will happen because the renters will own some of the batteries by virtue of owning vehicles and some of their appliances, and they'll be able to share a little bit in the savings in demand response and storage. But yeah, absolutely, we need to think carefully through how do you do this for, you know, multi-tenant housing? How do you do this for renters? And then in the fundamental trade-off of renewable energy is that you pay more up front because the energy is free later on. With fossil fuels, it's the other way. You get a cheap machine up front, but then you have to pay for expensive fuels for the whole life. We've solved problems like that with finance, and that's why we do mortgages, so we can buy expensive things and pay them off over 20 years. Right. But we need to make sure to buy this kit, we have access to that finance for 100% of households, not 50%, because if only the 50% of the wealthiest households can afford it, we don't get to zero emissions.
Saul, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I wish we could go longer. So many questions coming in. Clearly, people are deeply concerned and curious about how to progress the vision that you have laid out in part for us today. But in the meantime, thank you so much for taking the time here on Life Matters.
And thank you to you and your audience for your time.
Dr. Saul Griffith is an engineer, CEO, inventor, entrepreneur, founder of Rewiring Australia. His new book is called The Big Switch, Australia's Electric Future, and we'll have more details about Rewiring Australia and Saul's vision for that community and suburb on the Life Matters page.